all seem to say, throw cares away. Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to young and old, meek and the bold. Ding dong, ding dong, that is their song. Which joyful ring are caroling? One seems to hear words of a cheer from everywhere, filling the air. Gaily they ring while people sing songs of a cheer. Christmas is here. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. On and they send on with that end, their joyful tone to every home. Oh, how they pound, raising the sound. Oh, hearing the telling their tale. Ding dong, ding dong, that is their song. With joyful ring, all caroling. One seems to hear words of a cheer from everywhere, feeling the air. Gaily they ring while people sing songs of a cheer. Christmas is here. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Gaily they ring while people sing songs of a cheer. Christmas is here. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. Merry, merry, merry Christmas.
Merry, merry, merry Christmas.
You're listening to the Electric Sheep Film Show on Resonance 104.4 FM and DAB in London. I'm Electric Sheep Assistant Editor Alex Fitch, and you've just heard The Carol of the Bells, performed by Ambre McLean, a clue that this show is going to be somewhat festive, even while we look at the dystopian films that are being produced by British filmmakers. Later in the show, I'll be talking to the director and a couple of the stars of a new film warning of the dangers of virtual reality, The Call-Up. Maura McHugh will be talking about the somewhat neglected prequel to Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, in advance of the new TV show starting in 2017. And there'll be a variety of other Christmas songs performed by the likes of the Jive Turkeys and Louis Armstrong. As 2016 has sometimes felt a bit like the prelude to an apocalypse, tonight's show starts with the first of two interviews I've conducted with British filmmakers who have made new dystopian sci-fi thrillers. Tom Large wowed audiences at Sci-Fi London a couple of years ago with his gripping low-budget sci-fi invasion movie, Beyond, and in tonight's interview I'm talking to him about his latest movie, Arcadia. In this new low-budget thriller, Large explores the possibilities of a segregated society divided by the haves and have-nots who are desperate to get into a tower block called Arcadia, which will protect them from a disease that is running rampant through the population, controlled only by medication released periodically by government-backed corporations. To give you a flavour of Arcadia, here's an extract from the trailer.
Since the segregation policies were started, we have been responsible for over 400,000 people extending their life expectancy. Medication is the key to preventing further outbreaks.
You finish this job, you both get to go and live in Arcadia. Everything you've ever wanted. He's a level one primary target. We just need you to babysit him.
I know that you want this guy. Medical marvel, deity, whatever he is.
We can't let him fall into the hands of terrorists.
We need him alive and not in the tower.
Kill me and you lose your chance.
Now, Charlie, you're very, very close.
So your new film, Arcadia, is a return to the sci-fi genre. As we were saying just before I started recording, I previously interviewed you at the premiere of your film Beyond in 2014. You made another film in between, Tomoko, and now you've returned to sci-fi. Is it a genre that you kind of like to play with but don't necessarily want to stick with for every film you make?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, you know, it would be no harm if everything I made was sci-fi. I'm attracted to the story first and foremost. I think sci-fi sort of provides such a sort of a wide area for different stories and different kind of ways of telling things that sort of set in a present day setting might not be as sort of interesting or inventive.
And looking at your CV, Arcadia seems to form almost a loose trilogy of films kind of set in, if not the outdoors necessarily, but the outskirts where people are kind of banished from the city. If you also look at Beyond and indeed even the film you co-directed, Wounded, they're all about kind of being excluded from society for various reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's a decent thing to have picked up on. Yeah, they are all about sort of fighting the system to a certain degree, or being on the outside of things. I think that, you know, I think it's a well-worn path in a way, but it provides us, I think, interesting stories. People when they're put into difficult situations, particularly with Arcadia.
And I guess also if you're making a low-budget film. And you're kind of setting it either in the wilderness or in kind of remote farmhouses, it does make it easier with a lower budget.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, from a purely practical point of view, yes. I mean, you know, something we've always tried to do with, having low budgets, we always look at it and think, well, you've got to work with what you've got, you know. I sometimes get the sense that with low budget, people expect you to do a lot more. And I often think that's where you can start to look a bit sort of, you know, 1960 TV, you know, wobbly sets all around. And I think you've got to kind of work with what you've got, and that includes how you've set the story.
And indeed, the story of Arcadia seems very prescient, not only in the wake of Donald Trump's election in the States, you know, with the furthering disenfranchisement of the general population and the people in control. But also, I'm recording this interview in the radio studio at the University of Brighton, where there's a pharmacology department. And as I was walking to the studio, I passed various posters that they've put up about the whole antibiotics problem at the moment. You know, that if you've got a cold, don't ask for antibiotics. So really, you're also touching in to that problem that we have at the moment, that we're running out of the medicines we need and we don't know what we need to replace them.
Yeah, I think that we started Arcadia 2 years ago, and it's amazing how much has happened in that 2 years that have made Arcadia maybe seem not so distant future and more near future. You know, we do seem to slightly be running away from problems as the problems get bigger, and I think that, you know, there is every day that goes by and every sort of different thing that happens, there's an impending sense that, well, you know, something will get us. You know, whether it be, you know, the antibiotics issue, whether it be bees dying out, global warming, whatever it might be, you know, the huge global issues are stacking up. And I don't think it's as far-fetched anymore to picture a world like that set out in, you know, in Arcadia or in many different sci-fis that present a sort of dystopian future. Rather depressingly so.
Well, I mean, and indeed, the depressing nature of the story, although it does have a cathartic ending, reminded me a lot, actually, of 1984, where the kind of the ruins that the protagonists escape to look like, you know, the contemporary world, albeit a bit more broken down. But then there is kind of the central hub where the power base is, which is far more modern and futuristic.
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite interesting having had an audience see the film, and a couple of comments we've had is oh, well, it's not very, you know, it's not very futuristic. They've got all this technology in the tower, but everyone else just, it looks like today. And that was a choice, because, you know, even today, you know, we have certain technologies that in other parts of the world, they don't have anywhere near the technology we have. So this is just, you know, an extreme example of how that could develop. You know, if the government of the future makes sure that, you know, not everybody can access everything, you're going to end up with, you know, a limited group of people who have all of the best technology and everyone else surviving on what, you know, currently we consider to be good quality tech, but, you know, will slowly get drifted behind, you know, what the best thing out there is. Yeah.
Were there any particular kind of urban dystopias that influenced you both in the writing and the sort of visualization of your story?
Yes and no, really. I mean, some of those that you've already mentioned. To be honest, I try to... I'm very influenced by a lot of different films, but when actually sitting down to develop a specific story, you try to stay away from those things for a while. And the reason for that is essentially trying not to do two things, which is, one, you try not to ape anything that already exists, and you're trying to tell your own story. And then the second reason is that you kind of want what you're doing to sort of stand alone and develop the way that you want it to. But, you know, it's clearly influenced by a lot of, you know, sort of 1980s sci-fi. Whereas I think the style leans on more the sort of the lower budget independent sci-fi of the last few years, which takes a bit more of a practical real world approach. You know, look, that is a bit, again, why, you know, setting a large part of the story, and I think this was, you know, this was the same with Beyond, setting a large part of the story in the real world, it does make this sort of dystopian future not seem so far around the corner, you know.
Well, and also, I guess, you know, in these kind of scenarios, the grass is always greener, because your film, in a way, suggests the flip side of something like High Rise, where in that film, everyone living in the tower block is having a horrible time and maybe would prefer to be outside. Well, in this film, everyone outside is thinking it would be much more marvellous in the tower block.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's probably that's probably true at any level of any story. You know, everyone's got a boss, haven't they?
When it came to kind of location scouting, I mean, presumably the building itself is CGI, but finding the urban environment you wanted to set it in, was that something that came easily?
To a degree, yes. I mean, we did a lot of working with what we could get hold of and what worked. I mean, certainly the urban environment was the harder thing to get. There's the sort of two different settings for the urban, which is one which is inside the tower, which obviously our aim was modern, slick and clean. And then the other side of it was the set the part where we were with FreeCare, where they're in the city but they're still sort of banished from the sort of the rich area, the well off area of the town. And again, that was a bit of that was more difficult, to be honest, finding that, because, you know, a lot of places look quite nice nowadays. Yeah, so finding somewhere we could set those parts was more difficult.
Well, it's like, I mean, you know, no slight on Manchester, but when they were making the Captain America films, in order to find places that look like ruined London, they shot them up north. So, you know.
Yeah. They'll go to many different places. Yeah. There's been lots of suggestions.
With your previous sci-fi film Beyond, that was very much kind of, it felt a celebration of the landscape. While in a way this one is almost like a reaction to, if you find places to hide in the landscape, they're not necessarily going to be safe because something like disease or the worry of disease will come and get you. Do you have a kind of love-hate relationship with the landscape?
I guess I do. I think that with Arcadia, I really like the sci-fi films that, you know, we don't get a lot of now, but the intelligent sci-fi films with a big cast, you know, where we see different people operating in their roles. You know, I never want to do down a film, but I think if you look at, for example, if you look at the original Independence Day versus the most recent, the remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it, it kind of shows what's happened in big budget sci-fi. The original, I think, was very intelligent. It's a big cast. There's lots of different stories interweaving. And it's very interesting. The new one, I mean, I could barely get through it, to be honest, because it didn't have anything behind it. And you know, I've always liked Beyond. Was very much a sort of a story of two people and how they are left at the, you know, the end of the world. Arcadia for me was wanting to do something that was more of a conspiracy thriller, and seeing different people at different levels of that society and how they react to, you know, what happens.
Well, and indeed, dystopia seems to be a very kind of British way of doing sci-fi. If you think of the work of, say, John Wyndham or a TV series like Survivors, I don't know what it says about our society that we expect the worst when it comes to the future. But I guess it just holds up a mirror to the concerns that people always have at the time of their production.
Yeah, well, I also think you get this thing where if you expect the worst, then not the worst always seems better. You know, we do have that in us, as, you know, Brits and other countries as well. We have that thing of, you know, you expect the worst. When it's not so bad, you actually think, oh, well, that was all right. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of, if you expect the best, even middle ground is not going to be that great. So maybe, you know, by us sort of expecting World War III, we end up with something where we think, well, that didn't happen, so all is fine, you know?
Well, and it's interesting that hope, in a way, is represented in your film by acts of resistance. And that's obviously something that's felt quite prescient in recent years with the activities of Anonymous and WikiLeaks. But even today, over the last week, there have been, you know, demonstrations against Donald Trump in various US cities. But today, the mayor of New York basically said, keep going, you know, I encourage your activities. So, you know.
Yeah. It's again, it's another thing that I think, you know, 2 years ago when we sat and started this project, you know, protest groups, sort of extremist groups would never have been, you know, really supported. And there's several things that have happened in the last 2 years. You look also at the Black Lives Matter campaign, several groups that gain legitimate political support to continue their actions. And with the group within Arcadia, we did want to sort of take the idea of a group who are, you know, protesting against the government and are in the right, but how far is it okay for them to go? You know, what tactics is it all right for them to use, even though they are correct? And it's again amazing how much that's come to the fore, just even since release.
Yeah.
You know, we released 2 weeks ago.
Indeed. Yeah. So looking at your IMDb page, which may or may not be true, you have two films currently in production and pre-production, Slave by Name and Us, which seem to be following your pattern of doing a sci-fi film and then a non-sci-fi film and then another sci-fi film.
Yeah. It's not a plan. I'm sorry. Us is shooting in January. I can't say a huge amount about it at the moment, but it's sort of it's a couple who are desperate for money, and they head off to this research centre in the middle of nowhere to take part in a medical experiment. We sort of see what happens from there. Slave by Name's an interesting one. It's kind of similar to Arcadia, but in a very different way. It's a sort of teenage pop group are kidnapped, and their kidnappers try to raise their ransom for a crowdfunding campaign. So it's sort of asking their fans to pay for them to be released.
Okay.
And they're sort of pitting their fans up against their detractors. It turns into a bit of a dark thriller.
Hmm. Oh, well, that's almost speculative fiction.
Yes, yeah. It is. Yeah.
You do seem to be actually a fairly prolific filmmaker. When other people are struggling to get movies off the ground every 2-3 years, you seem to be actually pretty successful in getting one every year.
Yeah, we've been fairly, fairly lucky with that. I mean, I'd say one thing is we'd rather be making a film than waiting to make a film.
Sure.
And a lot of the time, we had to take our periods where we think we're developing new stuff and looking to get up to bigger budgets. At the same time, I think you only learn one way. You only learn by actually making films.
Mm.
And so if we can, we will make one. So if we can get the money together, we will. I think that, it's to a degree an unpopular point of view, but I think often filmmakers are taught that you only have one chance, and you only have one opportunity to make a great film. And it almost gets them caught up in, I've got to raise more money, I've got to do more things, I've got to spend more time on it. And, you look at all of the best directors, they've all got duds on their, on their CV at some point. And the point of that is that they've spent time just making films, and that's how they've learned.
Indeed.
Obviously you don't ever set out to not make the best film, but you I think you've also just got to take the opportunities as they come.
Yeah, and learn from your mistakes.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that too.
So in terms of you being able to make films on a regular basis and find an audience, is that because things have changed in recent years in terms of using the internet as a marketing tool and using video on demand platforms to distribute films?
Totally, 100%. I also think, 10 years ago, we wouldn't even be able to make them.
Wow.
5 years ago, we wouldn't even be able to distribute them in the way that is effective for getting them to an audience. I genuinely say, 10 years ago, I think these films would cost 10 times the amount of money, and because of in recent years the proliferation of digital distribution, you can also now reach more than 10 times the audience. Immediately. So, yeah, I think the opportunity is huge. I do think sometimes that can be over-egged. I don't think it's particularly beneficial to be telling young filmmakers they can shoot films on their iPhone. because if you look at any good film that's shot on an iPhone, it's using the phone purely as a capture device.
Yeah.
And
with a state-of-the-art lens attached to a remote camera.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I think sometimes that reporting of, you can shoot something on your phone now, you can edit it in iMovie, is making a lot of young filmmakers wonder why they can't do it.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So I guess maybe look forward to talking to you again when your next film's finished.
I hope so. Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Fantastic. My pleasure.
Cheers.
Arcadia, directed by Tom Large, is available now on DVD and from online download and rental venues such as Amazon Prime. As tonight's show is a mixture of darkness and light, darkness in the form of discussions regarding dystopian thrillers, and light in the form of various alternative Christmas songs. So to play out the first half of tonight's show, here's Louis Armstrong covering the Beatles classic, Give Peace a Chance.
Give peace a chance. chance, yeah.
Coming up next, Maura McHugh will be talking about the neglected prequel to David Lynch's iconic TV show Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, in advance of the 2017 revival of the program.
You know, David Lynch is very vocal about the fact that he practices transcendental meditation and has been doing so since the 70s, and he does it every single day, and he's a great believer in it, and that's where he gets a lot of his ideas. And people are always astonished that he's such a nice guy, you know, to meet, and yet he explores all these really dark things. And he also doesn't believe that you have to be unhappy to produce good art. And I think that's a very interesting thing about Lynch, he feels that it can actually stop you from making good art if you're unhappy and depressed and upset and things like that. And he also has said that, you know, you should love what you do, you know. So if it's a great struggle to do your work, then maybe, well, in his case, he would say meditation. It's good for you. It's good for your creativity. So he's always had this kind of, like, you know, attitude towards things. One of the things about the going back to the collaboration is that often elements, it's easy to imagine more into them than happened on set. There's actually quite a lot of examples of this in Twin Peaks and also in Fire Walk With Me. I mean, one of them is the scene in Twin Peaks where Agent Cooper goes to the vet to talk about the minor bird, and that was not directed by Lynch. And the director just came up with this idea, let's have a llama in the vet's office, right? And he even said, and he said he just came up with it, and that, and they did. And so, like, I guess he caught the spirit. That's someone who's sort of catching the spirit. And he even said there's this great moment, it is actually really funny, when the Cooper comes in and the llama's there, and he just looks at it. And for a split second, the llama and Cooper look at each other. And it's just a little moment. And the director said, like, that was his favorite moment, you know? And that's just something that just happens. You know, there's a spontaneity about filmmaking where all the influences of all the people come together. And you know, you can guess what I'm going to say about this coming into Fire Walk With Me, because there's a lot of weird stuff in this film, and the desire is to try and unpick everything. And I'm not sure I'm not sure that's what's going to happen, but I think it's still can be quite fun. And of course, the many faces of Laura Palmer. But the main impetus for Lynch to return to Twin Peaks was Laura herself. Lynch says, I felt really great about making Fire Walk With Me because I never felt complete with Laura. I never got to see Laura alive except in flashbacks. It allowed me to come full circle with the character. She always had a tremendous amount of life. For two seasons, everybody talked about her, yet I didn't get to do those things and be with her. So it was good in that way. He also said, I couldn't get myself to leave the world of Twin Peaks. I was in love with the character Laura Palmer and her contradictions, radiant on the surface, but dying inside. I wanted to see her live, move, and talk. So the girl at the center of the mystery of the TV show, who arrives dead, wrapped in plastic, was returned to life. So instead of being talked about and examined, she was actually given front and center to the film. And she's not the only person that he did that to, because actually, I'm going to say one thing now, is that I'm not going to be going at Twin Peaks in a linear fashion. I hate to tell you, I'm going to be jumping around and following a certain thread for me. So. I'm just gonna mention that now. But anyway, that's not the only person he did that with. Teresa Banks. Teresa Banks is just a name in Twin Peaks. Right, so Teresa Banks was given a character, and Ronette Pulaski, you know, she was also given, though she did, you know, crop up in Twin Peaks after she came out of her coma. And there is this, that moment when Special Agent Desmond and Sam Stanley are examining her body is so horrible, you know? And that's one of the things that Lynch says, you know, in that scene. He's like, he even says she's an unclaimed body. What is it? Deputy Cliff says something like, she was a drifter, you know, i.e. good, and nobody was claiming her, and she's this lonely dead body on a slab. Does that thing of which you have to be careful about with dead female bodies, you know, being kind of fetishized. But actually I find with a lot of Twin Peaks, it's often what could be considered sexy is actually also really unsexy, you know? And that's because he's trying to say that these things are sad or desperate, you know? And I think every time I look at that scene, you know, and the way he shot her face and how it looks in it, it's just sad. You know, she was this girl that was used by people and then just disposed of. And the deputy and the sheriff are obviously trying to cover stuff up as well. So, and then we see her as well as a master manipulator. You mean, she's not, Teresa is, I actually would love to have seen more of her. I mean, she's one, you know, beautiful, but she's savvy and she's canny. And she's actually trying to manipulate Leland, which is what kills her in the end. And then Ronette Pulowski, I mean, her friendship with Laura, you see it quite clearly in the show. I mean, they're two girls who are caught up in stuff. And the thing is, you know, her scene where they're being tortured, there's like a whole big section of Twin Peaks towards the end, which is really disturbing stuff to watch. Especially because of the journey he takes you on of getting to know these characters. And her genuine fear and terror, and again, geez, the acting is just superb. We'll get to that. So I will say that if you like Twin Peaks and Fire Walk With Me, you should definitely read this Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. It was written by David Lynch's daughter, Jennifer Lynch, and she was 22 at the time. The diary begins on Laura's birthday, July 22nd, 1984, when she's 12 years old, and already Bob is a presence in her life, right? It's clear, you know, and it's very, very well written. Actually, I was very impressed with it when I read it. Because obviously it's a first person point of view going on the whole way through it, and it follows through all the way just before Laura's death and charts her descent into despair, drug addiction, and but then there are always little moments of wonder and light. It's not like a terrible story, but you know, because you know Twin Peaks and you know all the characters in it, kind of interesting aspect, and it reveals things that are never quite explained. The horse that appears is a horse that Laura Palmer was given when she was I don't know if it was on her 12th birthday when that starts. But anyway, who gave it to her? Benjamin Horne, not her dad, right? So she thinks her dad has given her this horse. It isn't until years later she finds out Benjamin Horne gave it to her, right? Which, you know, shows a creepy interest right there. Like, and she was like, what, 12 or 13 when he gave her the horse? And she loved that horse. She wanted that horse very badly. And what then happens later on in that scenario, I won't actually spoil you with that. But what's fascinating about the diary is these huge contradictions in her life. She does like sex, right? She does like being tied up. She does like having sex with lots of people, and yet then she's got this awful abuse going on in her life. This is just really actually a very compelling read, and it tells you things about her, like she was bisexual, she liked having sex with women, and that's, you know, pretty much sort of, you know, gone through in the thing. And Bob is always written in capital letters, and it's beware of Bob, as she writes at one point. And he starts to talk to her in her diary. So there's these sequences where he's written all in capital letters and she's responding to him in the diary. It's really good stuff. It was published at the height of the Twin Peaks interest in 15th September 1990. It debuted at number 4 in the New York Times bestseller list. Jennifer Lynch has gone on to be a director like her dad. It spent many weeks on the chart, and despite this, several bookstores refused to carry the novel due to its very explicit content, and it is really explicit. It talks about her drug use. And actually, another thing that, again, sorry for me to spoil you in this regard, is that she had an abortion, like that is in the book. And I think that would be, you know, considering what she was up to, wouldn't be too much of a stretch. Jennifer Lynch herself does doubt that her father ever read the book, though. Cheryl Lee carried it with her throughout the shooting of the film, on the other hand. When she was doing Firewalk with Me, she had it with her all the time, and she was reading it all the time. So I think that is, you know, definitely a very interesting text to read, and it certainly gave me a lot of insight into the character as I was doing it. And it, you know, because like Cheryl Lee is having to do a performance of a very complex woman who's dealing with a massive trauma while struggling to have a decent, happy life, despite her belief that the angels have abandoned her. And I often wonder if the antagonism, especially initially, towards Fire Walk With Me is partly because the film is decidedly from a woman's perspective. And so a woman with many strikes against her, she's a junkie, she's promiscuous, she's a liar, she's a manipulator, a rape and an incest victim. She's also sweet and kind. She's a cheerleader, another American icon that is undermined. She is skilled at performance. She's learned the importance of facade and pretty face. She ends up being the kind of perverted fantasy of the American male, and so she is murdered. I mean, that there's a line about that in the movie. I think people went to Fire Walk With Me and they wanted Agent Cooper. And no, that's not what you get in Fire Walk With Me. Fire Walk With Me is about Laura Palmer, and that's it. If you can't get behind that, you're not going to like the movie. You know? Though, I mean, Agent Cooper is in it, and there's a very interesting thing going on with Agent Cooper in the movie. I mean, the first image we get of Laura Palmer in the movie, nearly half an hour in, after the shenanigans going on with the agents, it starts at it kind of gives her as the chirpy high school student. I mean, like within the minutes, that's what I mean about narrative. He's not slow with narrative, with the story. You see her sniffing coke in the bathroom, in the cubicle in the school, and having sex with her boyfriend, who is her boyfriend on the side, like James Hurley. And then there's her jock boyfriend, Bobby Briggs, who's, you know, always borderline abusive with her. And by the way, God, I hated Mike. There's a line in the diary where she actually is like, oh, I can't believe that Donna likes Mike, he's such a jerk. You know? I was like, yes, Laura. But hey, Laura had very complicated relationships with people. You can see when she's talking to Bobby, there's a scene where he comes up to her and she cuts him dead at the knees, like she's really cold. And then he's like, oh, well, don't come to me when you want your, you know, nose candy. And there's this amazing performance by Cheryl Lee. Her face just shifts, right? Really shifts. And she becomes, oh, Bobby. And then she gives the big cheerleading smile. And he just can't resist it. He just melts. And he's like, you know, baby, I'm going to sort you out. And, you know, so she's a chameleon. And she learned, she was taught, society has taught her, this is how she gets what she wants. And it's such a trap, because quite soon after that scene, you see the picture of Laura Palmer, the homecoming queen, in a cabinet of trophies in the high school. Mm-hmm. And that's what she is. She's a trophy, trapped, and that's it. That's her. And her awful struggle against this role that she has been given. You know, and you could say that she's powerful in that she has this power to manipulate men, but it's actually a sign of her powerlessness, because it's all done to either keep men from becoming aggressive or too cloying, like, you know, James. So, I mean, you know, later on I mentioned that that thing about when I was talking about the cabinet and the photo in the trophy cabinet. There's a scene later on with the two guys where she literally is being paid to have sex with them. Like, they put the money on the table and she looks at them and says, "So you want the homecoming queen?" And that's, like, again, you know, she's very aware. The thing is, and I know at one point, you know, Dr. Jacoby says it, he says she was so clever. And that's, of course, a terrible torture in a way. She's clever. She flippin' knows what's going on in her life. But what can she do to, you know, sort this out? She's attempting to negate this projected image of herself because it doesn't reflect how she feels inside. The schism between the outside reality and this internal experience is something that Lynch has an amazing talent for depicting on the screen. And he does this by transgressing reality and blurring the lines between dreams, visions, and liminal spaces. And what better space to launch this exploration than in the dream world of the American dream? And it is a dream, guys. You know, it's, you know, that's what it is. And it's a place he knows is a fiction. And where else to show that than in the home itself? This is something that Lynch said himself. The home is a place where things can go wrong. And oh boy, many of us know it.
Maura McHugh's exploration of Twin Peaks' Fire Walk With Me was recorded at the Miskatonic Institute, a monthly talk given at the Horse Hospital off Russell Square in London, and you can find information about all Miskatonic lectures by going to electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events. A bit more music next, and you'll hear Tim Phillips singing Song for Ten, a sci-fi themed Christmas song, which leads into the final interview that you'll hear tonight, in which I'm talking to the director and stars of the virtual reality thriller, The Call-Up.
Well, I woke up today, and the world seemed a restless place.
Finally on tonight's show, here's my interview with the director, Charles Barker, and a couple of the stars, Max Deacon and Ali Cook, of the new virtual reality thriller, The Call-Up. in which a bunch of gamers are invited into a corporate tower to try out new virtual reality equipment, first wowed by the realism of the war game surrounding them on their screens, they soon find that actually the competition is deadly and only one of them will survive. The interview with Charles and the cast of The Call-Up was recorded at a busy East End cinema as part of this year's Sci-Fi London Festival, so you'll have to forgive the background noise.
That feels like a very topical film. Virtual reality is kind of back in the fashion at the moment with technology. Was that one of the reasons why you made this now, or was there something else going on in terms of, you know, making this military, industrial, complex conspiracy thriller?
It was partly because, I mean, I started writing this a good 3-4 years ago, so it wasn't as topical. Yeah, lucky timing. virtual reality is going to be an incredible game changer in terms of entertainment. It's going to completely, the next few years, I believe, revolutionise entertainment. And I just kind of think it would be great to tell a story of how it could go wrong in the wrong hands, you know, the downside to it. And also, I'm a, like lots of other people, I'm a gamer, and people who play Call of Duty, I'm sure we've all thought we'd be like these superheroes if that game was for real. And I thought, you know, what happens if you did have those stakes and those shoot 'em up games like Call of Duty and what have you? And they were, you know, deadly stakes, and you would be all too human, you know, and that kind of interested me. So there are two sides to it.
And it's interesting that when there was the first flurry of virtual reality at the turn of the century, and you had films like The Matrix and The 13th Floor, none of those really dealt actually with the nature of playing games. They were about, you know, sort of going into a virtual world, but that weren't dealing with mechanics of gameplay. So it's interesting that you very much brought that to the fore in this movie.
Yes, I'm sure any gamers out there would recognise a lot of those tropes, the many pack and getting there in time. I think that grounds it and makes it a much more terrifying experience. If you have, you know, a lot of gamers by the age of 19 have played 10,000 hours of those games. Huh. So they really connect with those.
10,000 hours makes you an expert.
It makes you.
It's interesting, though, as well, that in terms of concerns about modern technology, you have this whole drone warfare thing going on, where it's possible that someone might be sitting behind a monitor, you know, in comfy old England, controlling a drone in the Middle East that's actually really killing people. So there is now this kind of blend of what is real and what isn't real.
There is a certain detachment, and the villain of this piece, you know, he wants all of the thrill without any of the risk. And that's why it's hopefully a lovely arc at the end when he gets... He's kind of trained up this character in the game and made her ruthless and made her a better soldier, and now she's got a gun. So it's kind of nice to get sort of burnt by his own tricks.
In terms of recruiting a bunch of people and making them ruthless, can you talk a little bit about the casting of this movie?
I was very fortunate with the casting. Awesome, all of them. Brilliant cast. Obviously, the key with an ensemble is to try and get contrasts. Yes. So you know, it is a very much a genre film. It's hopefully an entertaining film, and it's just getting that, those different types. So, and then killing them off one by one.
Was the film entirely scripted, or did you allow some kind of room for improvisation because it was about kind of the characters hanging out with each other?
We had fortunately. John here structured a good 2-week rehearsal period, so that was great to have that time with the actors, for them to get to sort of feedback and improve the scripts. No, it's definitely an actor brings so much to what you've written and fleshes it out in ways that you couldn't have thought of.
Were any of you gamers before you came across this project, or was it the director that made you care? Anyone want to watch that?
Yeah, I've had a lot of spare time on my hands. I've played some games and you know, reading the script, I started to, you know, I saw things I knew from that world and a couple of years ago I had a go at a job I did. We had a go on Oculus Rift. They put together an Oculus Rift for this film I did, and I got to actually have a go on the virtual reality thing. So I had a little idea of what that was like going into it. Yeah, I'm not sure how much it helped.
Right.
Ultimately, yeah.
Cool. And in terms of the technology, obviously we've not got to the point yet where you put down a helmet and it completely assumes reality in a total, you know, way like that. But is that a concern that you think people might, you know, turn on, tune in, and drop out?
This is the dream of developers. Yeah. So at the moment, it's very much the glitches are there, and it's very much the bleeding edge, and there's lots of problems with it. But this is like in maybe 10 years' time when they've ironed all that out, and they suddenly, you know, it's like having the technology from 10 years' time suddenly transported to now and making it so seamless you forget that you're wearing the suit.
Mm. I saw that in the opening credits, Creative England contributed to this film. Were there any worries? Thanks to them. Did they have any worries about doing a virtual reality thriller? Because when you think of Creative England, you think perhaps it's going to be a little bit, you know, safer, if that's not meant an insult, in terms of the projects that they fund.
I think they fund a really diverse range. The other, Richard Holmes is here, who is incredibly supportive of this project. But I suppose I just saw Creative England did She Bears Gifts and other genre-based interesting work. I never thought of them as being a bit conservative like that.
Does anyone in the audience have any questions for the director, cast, and crew? Let's get your hand up.
As usual, I probably don't need that, Alex.
Yeah, two quick questions. What was the length of the shoot from first clapperboard to wrap, and then you're into post-prod and VFX? And the second question is, London and Birmingham appeared as locations. I love our locations. I assume the office block was visors up, lovely clean lines office, and I assume with visors down in the game mode, it was some about to be knocked down the building in Birmingham. I assume that's the way it was. It may be the other way around, I don't know.
We love that you thought that.
Yeah, no, that's great. It was... Actually, I'd love to say this, New York as well. So we did actually go, we did shoot some of it in London. Some of it is actually, I shouldn't say this, shot in my house. And that is actually my cat. I know I shouldn't say the glamour of this. But we had a fantastic designer, production designer, Richard Campbell. And it's all the same building. We got a floor of a Birmingham office building, and then it was a very disjointed shoot. We shot everything in the real world. We, you know, built this office floor and shot everything in the real world, and then we came back, we shot some other things in other locations, came back, and it was all redressed as game world.
Yeah.
So, and then it was very precise. You know, every shot was very precisely storyboarded, and we it's great technology now. We had tablets to refer to the shot before, and so with the script very carefully plotted when you go in and out all the way through. So it was a lot of fun. It's something I love. So it was a challenge and a great experience as well.
It's irony.
The length of the shoot. It was a 5-week shoot initially, and then there was a couple of days. In New York, and a couple of days at my house.
Of course, it's ironic that a film about virtual reality, in order to provide a virtual reality environment, you actually have to dress the real world to look like it's fake. Any other questions?
Hi, everyone. Great movie. Why doesn't she take the money?
It would have made an inelegant shot. It's blood, buddy. It's tainted.
Yep.
Hi, guys. Great. I really enjoyed that. That was really, really interesting to watch. And I just wanted to ask about the... just about the American accents, was that a deliberate decision from your behalf because of sales?
Yes. I was told that I'd get much better international sales if it's set in America.
And have you?
Yes.
It is the most honest Q&A in the world.
Nobody is getting out of here.
I'm going to wrap this up in a second. No one can...
Charles, I just want to say thanks for inviting me to come today. I've met you at the Hackstock over the weekend, where we were looking at the real world technology that exists that actually relates to this. So I'm honoured to actually be here. One of the things I wanted to make a comment about and also ask a question about was, in the research that I do in virtual reality, what we found across Europe, across a lot of creative industries, is people saying it doesn't matter how fancy the technology is, unless there's a story that people can be gripped by, that they can relate to in an empathic way, then it's not really going to be a done deal. And what I noticed about the film was you spent a lot of time looking at empathy for the characters, and that made it gripping, it made it relatable. With regards to virtual reality, in your experience, from your mindset, can you just say what you think will not make virtual reality work until it's sorted? What things holding virtual reality back right now in terms of making it something that's more adoptable for people?
It's going to all be about emotional engagement and story. So you have the same problem with just gaming. There's certain games which really, for me, work, like The Last of Us, which I thought was both, you know, a really great sort of engaging action game and a great story. So it's about creating that dynamic of being both immersive and being drawn along by an engaging, empathetic journey.
Any other questions?
Just theoretically speaking, to ask the person who came up with the story, did the guy have a backup plan if, like, two or three people survived? Because he said, well, one person saying this wouldn't be believed.
That's a great question. That is called creative license. I get to kill them off and know they're going to die.
You notice how he's quiet here.
Do you know, I would love some questions for the actors and these guys. especially Boris, who's come all the way from Sarajevo tonight to be here. Yeah. So if any of you do have any questions for the actors, the magnificent Tommy, the editor.
How were the suits to wear?
Yeah. Oh. Oh.
Flattering.
Yeah, they were pretty brutal.
Yeah, by the end, they got a little... Because I think we only had one each.
Yeah.
So after 3 weeks of all day, every day, wearing those things, it was pretty... Yeah, they were pretty interesting.
Was it also you can't break them?
Yeah, you can't break them. At one point, there's a close-up of my hands holding the grenades, and we noticed on my suit that my hands were just...
They were knackered, eh? Yeah.
Knackered is a better word than what I was going to say. So we had to chop up a, like an old prototype suit and use them as the gloves, because my hands were gross. Had you been doing? I saw a question up towards the back.
Did any of you relate to any of your characters? The chance.
Yeah. No, for me, for example, it was a great thing that we, during the rehearsal process, we discovered that character can be from Sarajevo, where I'm from, and that he can be an immigrant. I don't know, because from 1992 to 1995 there was a war in Bosnia and a lot of my countrymen were, I don't know, spread across the Europe, some of them, of course, in England. So it was, for me, it was quite important to play a character from my country because of everything and the history and everything. So it was, for me, it was because of that I was really related with my character.
Yeah, it was cool to have the 2 weeks before to rehearse, you know, to come to those discoveries and get to. Although we didn't get if you no, a bit no, later, which was good because he showed up and scared us in real time. But yeah, no, on such a short shoot, it was 5 weeks and 6 day weeks, and to have the 2 weeks before to get to play and discover stuff and work around some of these scenes and, like, you know, whether or not. What we actually did on the day was what we did in the film. It was great to kind of get to know each other, and, you know, you always do that stuff. You always, you know, start with where I relate to the person and try and build something up there, and then you meet other people and maybe that falls apart a bit. So it was really great to have that kind of playtime with each other, and not only that, it made us all kind of closer as we went on, which is always helps when you're working in an office block for 6 days a week, falling over and being shot and all that.
I like the theme, and I didn't see my characters computer generated. I watched Apocalypse Now, and I looked at Robert Duvall and dealing with war, and so it was. I was taken by the story. Yeah. I really enjoyed the story.
Although playing a virtual reality character, presumably that also meant you had to bring a kind of staccato nature to the delivery.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm glad they didn't fuck with my voice. Originally the voice was, it was something else, and I was glad that there was a human element to it, because I think that's what computers aim to do, to bring us closer to each other. But what I did enjoy, I think you gave me a direction once of not looking directly at people, so my focus was always a bit skewed. So yeah, it was fun. Thank you. Thank you, Charles.
It was fun for him, and for us, like, where is he looking at? And you're supposed to look at him.
Chris's voice is awesome, and that's like a big part of kind of, you know, your character, and it was important. He was the mirror in Mirror?
No, Snow White.
Snow White and Huntsman, sorry.
Yeah.
And so kind of that, you know, that bassy voice you got was a big part of what brought that character out.
It really was.
Yeah.
Thank you. Hi, girl.
And of course, we have both producers here. If you have any questions for them.
Fantastic.
Well, how much did you have to keep the director to task to stay within budget and stay within the time limit?
Oh, that was very easy. Now, when you make a film, I think a director's job is kind of to push as much as possible, to get as much on screen as possible. So, really, if you offer 10 and they're not asking for 11, they should be. And it's kind of your job to keep it at 10, or at least 10 and a half.
I don't think we had enough time or money to fall out. We just had to get on with it. And Charles had a very strong vision from the beginning. Mm. As a writer-director, he knew the script incredibly well, and as soon as we hit the ground in Birmingham, really, it was just all hands on deck, but hopefully a lot of fun at the same time as well.
Sorry, there's a lady there.
Other than the chance to work with the great director Charles Barker, what was your proudest moment throughout the filming?
Blowing up a car, I think. Blowing up a car in a car park that was still active with people parking their cars.
Yes.
And the fire extinguishers.
And the sprinklers were still on.
And they just had rags on them.
Those sprinklers have got like mercury switches on them, which react to sound. And we had that gun was real, and it was louder than you could hear it in the film. It was really, really loud. So Matt and I, especially Charles, caring less. Of course, he wanted a shot.
Yeah.
But if basically the sprinklers came on, the cameras aren't covered. The cameras cost, you know, whatever it is, $100,000 each, or, you know, we would have been. So that was, I don't know about proud, but that was the scariest moment of my time on the shoot. I was terrified, absolutely terrified.
No. I did feel that when we finished shooting in the car park, that we somehow got out alive from the car park.
You've all played your own individual roles in a really cool plot with just lots of intrigue and lots of ideas about what could happen, what is possible. So if, say, in about 5 years, you get an invite to an experimental virtual reality experience, do you go?
Yeah, I reckon you do, yeah. Probably not going, so not really a biggie. So, I mean, providing it's not being ruled by a psychopath, and I think it's quite exciting. But I think that is the lure, isn't it? Is that it is? If that really was a game and it wasn't controlled by a nutcase, then it would be awesome. It'd be beyond amazing.
Thank you very much for bringing the film to Sci-Fi London. It's been a pleasure. It's a pleasure as well. Thank you.
Virtual reality thriller The Call-Up, directed by Charles Barker, is available now on DVD. And also as a download and rental from various online services such as Amazon Prime. Sci-Fi London, where the interview with Charles and the cast was recorded, returns to cinemas in London in May 2017, and for more information about next year's festival, please go to sci-fi-london.com. The Electric Sheep Film Show was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch, and the extract on the Miskatonic lecture on Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me by Maura McHugh was recorded by Virginie Selavy. You can find all previous episodes of the Electric Sheep Film Show on electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events, and we'll be back on air in 2017. To play out tonight's show, after a somewhat dystopian look at recent cinema, with hopeful thoughts about 2017, here's the instrumental Get Down Santa by Jive Turkeys. Thanks for listening.